So let's cultivate our motivation. In the page of the book we'll be reading from today, there's a picture of Buddhist monastics carrying a banner called Walk to Feed the Hungry. And although they were marching to bring awareness to physical hunger, the lack of food, when we think about it, sentient beings are hungry for so many different things. They have appetites for love and reputation, appreciation, social acclaim, you name it. It's possible for us to have hunger for it. So the problem when we have hunger is not that we don't have what we want. We think that's what the problem is, that we don't have what we want. But in fact, the suffering comes from the craving to have the object. Without the craving, whether we have the object or don't, our mind can still be content. But when the mind has craving, even if we get what we want, there's no satisfaction. So it's as if all the beings in the world, as far as we can see, are always craving, hungering for something and never feeling satiated, content, satisfied. So when seeing this kind of situation, let's look at it with compassion. Wanting beings to be free of the suffering brought on by craving. It's not sufficient just to want sentient beings to be free in that way. We've got to act. And so, as practitioners, our action is to improve the quality of our mind, gain realizations, and develop the powers so that we can be of the greatest benefit to living beings. And for that reason, we seek full awakening. So may that be, too, our motivation for sharing the Dharma this evening. I think one of the big skills we need to learn while in samsara is how to endure the frustration of not getting what we hunger for, not getting what we want. Yeah, because if we can develop that skill, then it's possible to have a life of contentment. But if we don't have that skill, no matter what we have, boy, we are restless and dissatisfied. So I think especially for parents, when they're bringing up children, you know, sometimes the kid is nagging so much, you just give them what they want so they'll be quiet. But that's not really helping a child. Always giving people what they want doesn't necessarily help them. It's better if we can teach them how to endure the frustration of not getting what they want. Yeah, because we won't always be there to give people what they want. But if we can help them to learn how to transform that situation and still be happy, then that's a great kindness. And then whether we're there or not, that person will know how to work with their mind. Of course, when we hunger for something, we want people to give us what we want, and we throw a temper tantrum if they don't. Yeah, we're still like little kids, you know. We show it in adult ways, but it's still, you know, stamp your feet and cry and pout and. So whenever we have the tendency to do that, it's good to remember, you know, the problem isn't that I'm not getting what I want. The problem is that I'm craving. And if I want to be happy, I have to learn to release that craving and learn how to be satisfied with what I have. Yeah. And to appreciate what we do have. So I don't know about you, but when I'm in the middle of a temper tantrum of craving because I can't get what I want, then I can't see what I even have. And I can't appreciate what I do have. My mind is totally sunk in suffering about, but I want this piece of chocolate. You know, I don't care what everything else I have. I want this piece of chocolate. Lama Yeshe used to use chocolate as our object of craving. It could be whatever is our own special thing that we crave. Okay, so we're on chapter 12. This is the last chapter in the book. And it's called Working in the World. I was actually going to put this chapter at the very end of the whole series. You know, after emptiness and tantra, then let's come back and work in the world. But then I thought, no, we can't wait that long. Yeah. And people want to understand this soon, you know, when they encounter the Dharma. This is a pressing question for most people. Okay, so His Holiness says, as Buddhists, and particularly as practitioners of the Mahayana path, we are part of the human community and have the responsibility to benefit that community. We should take a more active role in helping society by employing whatever talents and abilities we possess to help others, whether or not they are Buddhist. If the human community is happy and at peace, all of us automatically benefit. There's a lot in that paragraph, okay? So, you know, employing our talents and abilities to help others, okay? So it means that each of us have different talents and abilities. So we have to see what we're particularly good at that can be of service to others and then use that instead of developing some fanciful image of having qualities and abilities that we don't have and being, you know, the savior of the world or something like that. Yeah. But see what we have right now. Of course, we can continue to increase our qualities, but use them and don't compare ourselves to other people because we all have different aptitudes for different things. And the world needs all of the different skills that we can offer to it. Okay. And I say this because sometimes, you know, we really get into comparing ourselves. Oh, well, that person opened a soup kitchen. I can't do that. I wish I could. They're feeding so many beings. But I don't know. I can't organize something big like that, so I can't benefit sentient beings. And then we spend all of our time lamenting that we can't open a soup kitchen like our friend did, when meanwhile we have other skills we could easily offer that don't involve, so much energy, because we're already have familiarity with them. Okay. And I want to say, it's so funny how we practitioners are, yeah? When we study, and we're involved in a study program, we think, you know, this isn't it. I need to meditate more and gain realizations. But when we're in retreat, we think, I'm just sitting here, you know, looking at my navel, thinking about compassion. I should go out and do something for sentient beings. So then we stop retreat. We go out and do something for sentient beings. And while we're doing something, we say, I'm doing something, but it's really not having much effect. It's better if I study the Dharma. So we stop that, and then we go back to study again. So here we are jumping around between these three, always dissatisfied, always comparing ourselves to what our friends are doing. Oh, that friend is such a good student. They've studied so much. They know so much. I should do that. And then you're studying. Oh, but that friend has been in retreat. They've done, you know, 5 3-year, 3 month, 3 day retreats. I really should go and do retreat. Then we go and do retreat. You know, oh, I'm just sitting here. Yeah, I said so many mantras. So what? Big deal. I meditated, you know, and I can follow my breath. Yeah, so what? I should do something to benefit sentient beings. And look at all my friends out there. They're doing things that are really actively benefiting sentient beings. And I'm just sitting here. So, you know, always comparing ourselves, always dissatisfied, you know. And then, no matter what we're doing, we waste our time feeling dissatisfied and criticizing ourselves and comparing ourselves to others. And it's a huge waste of time. What do you think? A waste of time? Yeah. Doesn't get us anywhere, does it? Yeah. Okay. So then also His Holiness is saying in this paragraph that we should help others whether or not they are Buddhist. Okay? So we help human beings because they're human beings. We help animals because they're animals. We help all beings. We don't just help the people who are on our team. Okay? Yeah, because this is not an effort of it's not a thing of dividing into teams and, you know, benefiting our team and kind of scorning the others. And then he says, if the human community is happy and at peace, all of us benefit. Yeah? So you look at the difference between His Holiness saying that and Donnie's saying, you know, we don't need to fight on that blood-soaking land. Let the other people battle it out. Yeah, we'll just guard the oil to make sure that we get it. But in terms of human beings losing their lives, we don't care. They can fight. Yeah. So, you know, there's a big difference there. Between the mind that says, let's help others, whether or not they're on our team or not, and the mind that says, we're only looking for out for ourselves. Yeah. I remember after he got elected, you know, people were writing into us and asking questions. And I have, you know, so I was trying to help and explain things. And I was saying how the thing of America first, it didn't sit well with me, because we're one global community and we influence each other. And somebody wrote in and said, oh, but he's not saying America only, he's saying America first. But if we look 1,000 and some days later, it's become America only. Yeah. Hmm? Oh, yes. Okay. So people's differing temperaments are reflected in two types of compassion. The first wants others to be free of their suffering and problems, but still prioritizes happiness for oneself. That's America first. The second not only wishes others to be free of suffering, but is also prepared to act to bring this about. I don't have a national example for that. It'd be nice one day if there were. The experience of compassion is similar in the two, but due to focusing more on the well-being of others and the disadvantages of self-centeredness, the second compassion is courageous and actively engages with others. Okay, so the first compassion, we want others to be free of suffering, but, we prioritize our own happiness. So this is most of us. Our own happiness first. Whereas what His Holiness is advocating is really seeing how we are all equal in wanting happiness and not suffering, and then working for the happiness of all. There's a statement in Shantideva's text that I can't quote it exactly, but if it's suffering, it's to be, no matter whose it is, it's to be eliminated. Yeah. And that makes sense, doesn't it? Doesn't matter whose it is. Suffering is undesirable.
Excuse me, you said that you don't have an example for the second not only wishes others to be free of suffering, but also prepare to act to bring this about. I think, and I believe in that many, many Americans are having the wish for others to be free of suffering alone within a family context or communities.
Yeah.
And because the people are the nation. Mm-hmm. The people are the nation. It's not just the politics. Mm-hmm. So because you said you don't have a nation, an example for a nation, but I immediately thought, what about all the people who are really interested in wanting to relieve the suffering and act about it?
That's fine. Mm-hmm. I was talking about nations. What you say is true, and what I say is also true. We're talking about two different things. You're talking about the individual people. I'm talking about the nations. Yeah, but not everybody in this nation is willing to forego their own happiness for the welfare of others. Some people are, some people aren't. When you talk about a nation, you have to have a lot of people on board, including the government. I would like to continue teaching, if people could hold their questions a bit. Okay, there are many ways for those who wish to alleviate misery to apply Dharma principles to their interactions with family, society, and the surrounding world. As we actively help others, we must continue to meditate on the two methods to generate bodhicitta, using reason and concrete examples to increase the strength and scope of our compassion and to prevent it from degenerating. So the two methods are the 7-point instruction of cause and effect, and the second method is equalizing and exchanging self for others. And His Holiness is saying we have to use reason and specific examples in our life to cultivate those. So developing love and compassion isn't just a matter of sitting there and saying, compassion, 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 compassion. That's not how we develop it. We have to think of, see, cultivate the mind that sees sentient beings as lovable and cultivate the mind that is aware of their dukkha. And when we do that, then we can bring about compassion. Okay, so we not only have to bring about compassion, we have to strengthen it, we have to expand its scope to more and more living beings, and we have to prevent it from degenerating. Okay, so we can't just say, oh, I'm cultivating compassion, this feels good, I have so much more compassion than I did before, so now I don't need to meditate on compassion anymore. Yeah, I've got it. I don't need to meditate on it anymore. If we think like that, our compassion is going to go whoop. Okay? Because any, you know, good quality needs to be continuously cultivated. Yeah, until we reach very high levels of realization. We can't just say, oh, well, I've got that, and, you know, I got that nailed down, let's go on to the next thing. Now, and especially with love and compassion, we're warned so often in the teachings, you know, told the story about Shariputra and how he, you know, lost his bodhicitta, and given different examples of people losing their bodhicitta because of encountering some obnoxious sentient being. Yeah, or some sentient being who may not be obnoxious, but that person interprets their behavior as obnoxious and then gets upset and angry and eliminates that person from the feeling, the scope of their compassion. And if you do that, then you're if you had bodhicitta, it's degenerated. So I have to be quite careful of that. Good health and a positive attitude are assets when we work to benefit others. So we will turn to these topics first. Reflections have not been included in this chapter, so please pause at the end of each section to reflect on its main points and how they relate to your own experience and aspirations. Yeah, because the reflections, you know, to put in all of these would be pretty much the same. Yeah, make examples from your life, think of how to cultivate that, think of how to sustain it and keep it from degenerating. Okay, so the next section is called Good Health and Dealing with Illness and Injury. So, everyone desires good health, and for Dharma practitioners, it facilitates our ability to practice. For this reason, we should do our best to maintain our health by eating nutritious meals, exercising, and sleeping enough, but not too much. Now, let's pause here. Of those three things, eating nutritious meals, exercising, and sleeping enough, but not too much. Okay. Just do a quick check with yourself. Do you feel like you're doing those three? Are there areas where you fall short in maintaining your own health? Yeah. How do you fall short? Okay, so you haven't done the exercise part. Other people?
Okay, on the exercise, got a good night's sleep, not too much, but I eat way too much butter and way too much soy sauce, and I do love chocolate.
Okay, you're the on sleep.
I have been doing these three for 2 weeks. It's actually taking a lot of effort. I go for a walk every day. But, you know, so you can imagine I
you know, haven't kept that up for a long time.
Do you feel better?
Yes, a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we feel better because we take care of ourselves, then we could really practice better and serve others better and not be so grumpy. Yeah. Okay. Oh, there was also another part in this sentence, and maintaining good standards of cleanliness. Okay. So that we don't get sick. Yeah. Here, our motivation is not attachment to pleasure or fear of pain. It is the opportunity good health provides to use our precious human life for Dharma practice, and specifically to cultivate bodhicitta and wisdom in order to benefit all sentient beings. Okay, so we're taking care of ourselves, not out of, you know, this anxiety of, oh, I don't want to get sick. I hate being sick. I might die. I'm so nervous about getting sick. And so I got to have this food, otherwise I'll get sick. And, you know, I've got to have exactly this much sleep. Don't disturb me. I just don't do well. And, you know, so it's not like that, that we're so anxious and attached to our own body that we have to get everything, and we're always knocking on the kitchen door. I need more protein. I need more this. I need less that. Give me this. Give me that. Driving everyone nuts. Okay. So it's not done with that kind of motivation. Yeah. It's done with the motivation of we want to practice, we want to be able to serve others. And to do that, we have to have a healthy body. Yeah, if we don't have a healthy body, then we're lying in bed, then everybody else is having to run food over and run food back and do your dishes and, you know, care about this and run around there to take care of you, you know, and people are very kind doing that. But, you know, if we could take better care of ourselves, then maybe they wouldn't have to. Okay, so it's not with the selfish motivations. It's like if you want to get somewhere in a car, you have to keep your car in good condition. So, you know, we're in this vehicle, we got to give it tune-ups, okay? But, you know, giving it tune-ups and taking good care of it isn't a matter of, oh dear, it got this little scratch. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, I have this, my little toe is killing me. You know, I can't go to teachings. My little toe is just killing me. You know, people don't understand when I don't show up to teachings. They say, well, your little toe is going to hurt whether you're in the room with teachings or whether you're in your bedroom. So you might as well come to teachings and get some benefit because your toe's going to hurt anywhere you are. And they say that to me, but they don't understand that my little toe is, you know, okay? So watch the mind that goes into fits like that with so much anxiety about our own body, you know, where we can't be peaceful. We're just tense and anxious all the time. Yeah. So you know, we also need to have the ability to relax and, you know, sometimes we get sick. It's not the end of the world. Yeah. Sometimes we don't feel well. It's not the end of the world. Okay. And it's very interesting, the people who don't come to teachings because they don't feel well. And how many times do you remember me canceling teachings because I didn't feel well? I don't do it. If I don't feel well, I come. I'm here. Yeah? So just think about it. Mm-hmm. Balance is important. One meaning of the middle way is to avoid the extremes of self-mortification and self-indulgence. Physical suffering comes naturally, simply because we have a body. deliberately inflicting pain on our body does not purify our mind. And that's what the Buddha's whole thing about practicing asceticism for 6 years was dramatically illustrating. Okay. In fact, severe ascetic practices could become another form of self-centeredness if the motivation is to gain a good reputation for having the ability to tolerate pain. And asceticism can also become a big arrogant trip. Yeah. When I lived at Copan, the rooms where we slept on the floor was brick, cold brick. And we had a straw mat, not a mattress, a mat, to put on, and that we slept on that. And there was one monk, and he took the straw mat off and was sleeping on the brick, the cold brick. And I remember Lama Yeshe, because he would walk around and inspect our rooms and everything. And he walked into this monk's room, and he said, "You're on such an ego trip, thinking you're doing some big ascetic thing. Go get your mat and put it back here and take care of your body." You know? So, yeah. Because sometimes, yeah, we can get that thing of, oh, I'm going to be ascetic. Then everybody will see how renounced I am. You know? But our motive is reputation. Self-indulgence, okay, so that's the self-mortification part. Self-indulgence, this is more our problem. Yeah. Self-indulgence hinders Dharma practice by consuming our time. Instead of practicing the Dharma to go beyond the samsaric situation of having a body under the influence of afflictions and karma, we spend inordinate time and energy pampering our body and worrying about its health and its comfort. Okay, so that's what I was just saying. Some people are like, oh, I have the sniffles. Oh, this is terrible. I'm going to wind up in the hospital with pneumonia. I better stay in bed. Yeah. So just any small thing, we get so full of anxiety, so full of fear, because there's so much attachment to the body. Yeah. So if we have that kind of anxiety and fear and attachment to the body, then for our own sake, we should really meditate more on what the body is. Do the meditation on the different parts of the body so you see the body for what it is and try and release that attachment. Because if we're attached to the body now, yeah, imagine what it's going to be like at the time of death when we have to separate from it. Yeah, if we can't endure. We're so attached to the body that we can't endure even any minor discomfort now. What's it going to be like, yeah, when the body's dying and there's pain and when we don't have a choice and we know we have to separate from the body at that time, yeah? So in preparation for death, we really need to work with our mind now to reduce the attachment to the body. Yeah, because we have we may think we don't have much attachment to the body, but look what happens when one small thing, we get so tight. So I don't think we want to die like that. And the thing is, we're the only ones who can transform our mind and our relationship to our body. No one else can do that for us. It is wiser to accept that as long as we are human beings in cyclic existence, we will have a body that is prone to illness. Falling ill is not some unusual or unique fate that we alone suffer, nor is it punishment or indicative of failure on our part. And that said, because if you ever do any hospice work, yeah, there are people who feel that when they get ill and their body is going downhill, that it's because God or is punishing them, or because they failed in some way. All this way of thinking is quite irrational, and it doesn't make any sense, but people's mind cling on to these kind of wrong ideas anyway. Yeah, so it's very important to look in your own mind, and if those ideas are there, to root them out. And when you're, you know, helping other people who are dying, be sure to let them know that, you know, illness and death are not failures. This is just natural, okay? It's nature, and they're not punishment. So best to relax. Mm-hmm. Accepting the limitations of having a samsaric body and understanding it is the basis of our precious human life. We must use it wisely without fussing over it. Do you like to fuss? Yeah? Who likes to fuss? People often write me, His Holiness talking here from his experience, people often write me for advice regarding illness. Although my responses vary according to the illness and the person's mental disposition, I will share some general advice to help others. When you are ill, you should consult a doctor and follow his or her advice. It sounds like, why does he even have to say this? But how many people, when they're ill, don't go to the doctor? Yeah. In the Tibetan community, many people don't go to the hospital because they think the hospital is where you go to die. So many people don't go to the doctor because they're afraid of getting a diagnosis they don't like. And I've talked to people who have told me that they're aware of their own way of thinking and have said, you know, I don't feel well, but I don't want to go to the doctor because I don't want to hear actually what the diagnosis is. Okay. And then if you go to the doctor, follow the doctor's advice. How often do we get the medicine, we put it somewhere, and we don't take it? Or the doctor says exercise and we don't. The doctor says lose weight and we don't. The doctor, you know, gives all sorts of advice and we say thank you very much, bill it to my insurance, and then we don't follow it. Yeah. We've had that happen in the community, haven't we? I won't mention names, but yeah, you know, reflect on that. So, yeah. So don't, His Holiness says, do not abandon conventional medicine in favor of faith healing. Okay, in Tibetan culture, yeah. If somebody is ill, then now they're going to doctors. But before, you know, they didn't know much about. They had Tibetan medicine, which in some instances it really works well and sometimes better than Western medicine. But often what people would do is they would go to a lama. The lama would say some mantra and then blow on the person. And then that was you know, by the power of the mantra and the person saying it, then when they blew on the person, it would heal whatever it was. Okay? So His Holiness, I think he realizes that doing that makes some people feel better, so psychologically it's quite good and might help them. But he's saying don't abandon conventional medicine, just thinking that doing some practice alone will heal you. It happens that someone comments to a cancer patient, "Your anger caused the cancer." We're talking about this at lunch. Imagine this is right what's in the book. Such, His Holiness says, such comments not only lack compassion, they are mistaken. Diseases come about due to many causes and conditions, and blaming someone who is ill for their disease is heartless. So we don't do that. It's really, it is heartless, you know. How somebody's supposed to feel. So you say, well, you know, your negative attitude made you have kidney disease. How's that supposed to help somebody? The mind training practice of seeing our illness as a result of destructive actions we have done in previous lives or earlier in this life is very different than blaming the victim. Okay? Seeing illness in this way does not mean that we deserve to suffer. No one deserves to suffer. Rather, we act and experience results that accord with those actions. Daisy seeds grow into daisies. They don't produce chilies. Thinking in this way enables us to release our anger and our sense of injustice and accept the situation. Okay? So, you know, I find it very effective when I'm in a bad mood, when there's mental or physical, I don't feel well, if I say this is a result of my own destructive actions, it helps my mind so much. Because then I don't get angry, I don't feel it's unfair, I don't blame anybody else. You know, I say, yeah, it's a result of my own destructive actions. And if I don't like this result, I better change how I act. Yeah. And then I look at the kind of, you know, actions that could be causing this kind of result and develop some intention. You know, okay, now I've got to be really careful about doing that kind of action because I don't like this karmic result. And then that's quite beneficial. Because that's what's called learning from our mistakes. Yeah, that's how we really learn from our mistakes. Okay, so doing this transforms a bad situation into a learning experience. Because we understand that if we do not like suffering results, we should abandon creating their causes in the future. This gives us great impetus to let go of destructive actions and negative habits. Yeah. Thinking that the karma that caused the illness could have instead ripened in a far worse suffering helps put our misery in perspective. Cancer is not at all pleasant, but if that karma had ripened in an unfortunate rebirth, we would have been in an even worse situation. Reflecting in this way helps us to realize that we can, in fact, endure our present misery. In addition, because that karma has now ripened, its energy has been consumed and cannot afflict us again. Okay? So if, I think that many of you have heard me tell the story of one of my Dharma friends who was doing retreat, she got a big boil on her cheek. She was walking around the monastery and bumped into our teacher. And, you know, she, Rinpoche, I have this big boil and it hurts so much. And Rinpoche goes, great, fantastic. And she's going, huh? Huh? Where's your compassion? You know, kind of, I want some pity. And you're telling me it's great to have this boil. And then he went on to explain, well, this is a result of some kind of negative karma you created in the past, which is now ripening. So you should rejoice because now, you know, first of all, that karma could have ripened in a really horrible rebirth. It didn't ripen in that way. It ripened in getting sick as a human being. You know, compared to the suffering of a horrible rebirth, we can endure some pain from illness as a human being, can't we? Yeah, it may not be pleasant, but it's certainly better than an awful rebirth. So if you think like that, yeah, then the pain, the discomfort from the illness doesn't bother you. And then on top of that, if you think, oh, it's actually good, now this karma's ripening, it's finished, so it can't ripen again as some other horrible a thing that happened, it's over and done with. Yeah? And so then you feel good, you know? Okay, that karma ripened, finished, now I can go on. Yeah? And by thinking in that way, you actually transform the situation so that your karma is getting purified. If you don't think in that way, then you're miserable, and your karma is ripening, but there's not the purification effect, okay? The karma ripens, it produces its result. With purification, the karma is ripening and a lot of other karma is going to be prevented from ripening because you're purifying. Whereas if the karma just ripens, you know, you're not preventing other karma from ripening. You're just experiencing the result. Okay? So he's giving us, you know, really helpful mind training techniques. Now, whether we choose to use them when we're sick, that's another question. Whether or not we even remember them when we're sick, that also is another question, okay? So that's why it's very good, you know, to write these techniques down and then practice them even when you're feeling well so that you remember them. And also because, you know, usually every day or every few days, something about our body doesn't feel good. So even if it's a small thing, if you practice thinking in this way, again, you're familiarizing your mind with this way of thinking, and it's very helpful because then if a big illness or a big injury comes, you're familiar with the technique and you can use it. Yeah. I've been asking you to pray for this young man in Singapore whose mother has been writing us. And the family, the parents are quite Buddhist. The son is not so interested in the Dharma. And I would, you know, really like him to be able to use these techniques. But I don't know, one, if he's receptive, and two, if without having practiced before, he would even try and use them now. So instead of giving advice about this technique in particular, which I personally find effective, I told his mother to ask him to recite Om Mani Padme Hum. You know, because even that, if he does that, that will help him quite a bit. Okay, but what I'm getting at is if we prepare in advance, then we know what to do, and we do it, and we're okay. Yeah, but if we're a leaky pot and the teaching goes in one ear and out the other, yeah, then we don't know what to do. Distinguishing between physical pain and mental suffering is crucial. Even if your body is ill, your mind can remain peaceful and in a relaxed mind, and a relaxed mind will lessen your suffering and help the body heal. Okay? So this is really true. Your body can be sick, but if your mind remains peaceful, yeah, you recover much quicker and you don't suffer nearly as much. But if you don't feel well and then you get anxious and you get into that thing I was just talking about, oh, this is a disaster and a catastrophe and it's so painful and I've got to go to bed right away and I'm sure I'm going to die from this. When your mind gets revved up from that, like that, then that attitude is going to, you know, you're going to feel worse mentally. And the attitude will prevent the physical healing too. It will interfere with that. Okay. So His Holiness says, sit quietly and observe the difference between the actual physical pain of the illness or injury and the mental suffering caused by fear and anxiety. This is so interesting to do. Do this when you don't feel well. Just sit and try and differentiate in your own experience what is the physical pain or discomfort and what is my mind having fits, you know, and getting anxious and creating a worse case scenario. Try to differentiate between what's happening to you physically and what's going on in your mind. Okay? If you're nervous, if you're worried, if you're fearful, if you're apprehensive, yeah? If you're even rejoicing because now you have an excuse to stay in bed. Yeah? You think we don't know. Yeah? But we do. Yeah. Then look at, you know, what's going on in your mind and what is actually going on in your body. Differentiate them. By letting our preconceptions proliferate and imagining all sorts of horrible things that could happen due to our illness or injury, our mind can cause us more misery than our physical condition. It's true. Yeah. Instead of indulging the anxiety, bring your attention to a wholesome way of viewing the situation. Contemplate the kindness of those who are taking care of you. By doing so, you will be filled with strong gratitude, and your mind and heart will be at ease. Can you remember experiences in the past when your mind has just gone crazy with fear and anxiety? Yeah? And can you remember, maybe or maybe not, times in the past where you've been able to press the pause button on that and just sit and accept the situation and practice one of these Dharma methods? Yeah? There's a big difference between when we let our mind go and, you know, create horror stories and when we rein our mind in and direct it towards something positive. That's why my experience of hepatitis, I'm so glad I had it. It totally changed my relationship with the Dharma, completely changed it. Because before that, I was always feeling I should practice the Dharma. You know that should mind? I really should practice more. I should practice better. I should. But, you know, I'd much rather do something else. After I got hepatitis and somebody gave me the Wheel of Sharp Weapons, my attitude changed to I want to practice the Dharma. Because I saw that the Dharma was what was going to save me from all that pain and physical and mental, whatever, yeah. Remembering that tragedy is not unique to ourselves also helps to broaden our view and prevents us from falling into self-pity, which only increases our misery. Really? Tragedy is not unique to ourselves? I think it is. Yeah. When I don't feel well, or I'm in a bad mood, no one else in this universe has ever suffered as much as I do. Yeah. Do you think like that sometimes? Yeah. Nobody can understand my suffering. I have worse suffering than anybody else, and the world doesn't understand how extreme my suffering is. And we throw ourselves a pity party, which only makes the suffering worse, doesn't it? So remembering that tragedy is not unique to ourselves. I mean, look at the trick the self-centered mind plays on us, making us think that we're the only one who's ever had this kind of misery. When you think about it, that's really dumb to think like that, isn't it? How can we think like we're the only one who's ever had this kind of misery, or that our misery is worse than anybody else's? You know? So if that happens, we can contemplate at this very moment many others are experiencing far worse miseries, and many of them have no protector, no refuge, and no friends to help them. I am more fortunate, for I can rely on the three jewels. And I have so many friends and relatives, and even strangers, such as the hospital staff, are helping me. For someone who is ill, my situation is quite good. Yeah? I mean, imagine when you don't feel well, imagine living in a third world country and having that illness. Then what? Yeah, what do you do? They're just, you know, unless you're extremely wealthy, the healthcare isn't there. Yeah. And it's amazing what people go through when there's no healthcare. They have no choice. Okay, so when we think about that, boy, our situation is really good. Here I have all this negative karma ripening. So it's finishing. Plus, I have people helping me and I have access to medical care. Wow. Then, so think like this. Then send love and compassion to others who are ill, injured, or unjustly imprisoned by wishing them to be free of misery and to have all happiness. You can combine this with the taking and giving meditation described in chapter 7. Okay? So you think like that and you do the Tonglen, or just a simple way of thinking, you know, may my pain suffice for the pain of all people who are having a similar experience. Yeah, you think of everybody else having that experience and worse. And you think, may my pain suffice for what they're going through. Remembering that such problems are characteristic of cyclic existence helps us generate the determination to be free and to attain liberation. This gives our Dharma practice a big boost by helping us to make Dharma, not the eight worldly concerns, our priority in life. In addition, suffering has some benefits. It makes us humbler and helps us to open our hearts in compassion for others. So it's true, when we undergo suffering, our arrogance goes out the window, doesn't it? And that can be quite useful. If you have a problem with arrogance, having our arrogance go out the window and being dependent on others and not having power to control our own situations, having to accept things, it can be very good for our practice. Okay, and then it also helps us to open our hearts in compassion for other people. Visualization practices can also be useful. At the place where you experience pain, visualize the syllables of a mantra or a ball of light. Its brilliant yet gentle white light radiates and fills the painful or diseased area, purifying all illness and pain and filling the area with bliss. So try that. Alternatively, imagine the Buddha or a meditational deity such as Avalokiteshvara or Tara in front of you or on the crown of your head. Light and nectar flow from the Buddha or the deity into you, purifying and healing your body and restoring the balance of the elements. Okay, so you can also do white Tara practice, medicine Buddha practice, any of the practices, and you just think of the light and nectar coming in and completely purifying the karma that caused that and bringing compassion and bliss into your own mind. Doing purification to cleanse the karma causing the illness is also helpful. Purifying karma that has already ripened or is presently ripened isn't possible, but the karma that perpetuates the illness in the future can be purified. However, when karma is extremely heavy, preventing it from ripening altogether is difficult, although purification can make the result shorter or less severe. It also makes the mind more peaceful and thus better able to handle the illness. Think of situations in your own life where this applies, and then think of the Dharma remedies to apply, and then practice those Dharma remedies. Okay, now the next section is called Maintaining a Positive Attitude. Okay. So except for a few rare individuals who can devote their full energies to meditation 24 hours a day, the majority of Buddhists should remain active in helping their communities. Social engagement is vital, but without meditation, our work in society may not become a genuine Dharma activity. Okay, so we really need to, if we're going to be socially engaged, we have to maintain a Dharma practice so we keep a good motivation. Yeah. Roshi Joan, Halifax, yeah. When Russell and I sent her a copy of our book, An Open-Hearted Life, and asked her to write an endorsement. And in it, because the book is about cultivating compassion, we discussed what is commonly called compassion burnout. Yeah? So you've heard that term before. Everybody accepts compassion of burnout. Not Roshi Joan. She wrote back and she said, and she's right, if you burn out being compassionate, then it wasn't really pure compassion. Yeah. And she's right. You know, pure compassion doesn't burn out. It's always there. We physically may not be able to continue doing the activities to help somebody, But the compassionate wish that they be free of suffering and the wish to be involved if we could be, that won't change. Yeah. Whereas with compassion burnout, we usually think, I've worked so hard. I've done so much. I've sacrificed so much. I am exhausted. I wish these people would just leave me alone already because I need to take care of myself. So there's some anger in there, isn't there? Yeah. So she's saying, you know, that we really have to continually use our practice to filter out the self-centeredness in our compassion so that we don't have compassion burnout. Although, like I said, sometimes physically we may not be able to continue, but mentally we remain engaged. Social engagement is vital, but without meditation, our work in society may not be genuine Dharma activity. On the other hand, without a social component, our practice of benefiting others may not be truly effective. It may just be intellectual. Yeah? Balance is important. Have you ever had the experience in your meditation of saying, yeah, you know, I really feel compassion. I'm ready to go out and do that. And it may be just some small thing helping somebody you live with some small thing. And you feel completely capable and happy about doing it in your meditation. And then you dedicate the merit. You stand up. That person says, could you do me a favor? And your mind goes, no, it's inconvenient. Ask somebody else. You ever had that happen? Yeah? So this is why being active in the world is very good for our practice, because it will show us where we're lacking. Yeah, it comes out very clearly when the mind says, forget it. Yeah, so it's good, because if we don't encounter situations like that, then we may think, oh, I'm so compassionate. This is really great. But actually, our compassion is quite intellectual. Whenever you can offer help, and whenever you can offer direct help to others, do so. In Tibet, when I saw animals on the way to be slaughtered, I would send someone to buy them, and we gave the animals shelter. In India, seeing animals in cages on trucks pains me a lot. That pains me too when I see that here, and in India you see, like, you know, sometimes you see the cows in the big containers, you see the chickens in the cages, and you know they're going to get slaughtered, and it's, ugh. So he says, you know, it pains me a lot. However, I cannot pull over the trucks and buy the animals. Yeah, can you imagine flagging down a truck on the highway? Yeah. Instead, I recite mantras and prayers for them, reflect on karma, and generate compassion. Although one time when I was staying at Tushita Center in Delhi, I walked in and there was a chicken in the center walking around, a chicken. And I said, what's the chicken doing here? And somebody said, oh, well, somebody was going to kill it, so Rinpoche bought it here for us to take care of. So there in the middle of Delhi, in the Dharma Center, is the chicken. Yeah. Countless sentient beings toil in cyclic existence. All of them are caught up in the three types of dukkha: obvious physical and mental suffering, suffering because happy circumstances are fleeting, and suffering by being under the influence of afflictions and karma. Of course, we cannot solve all of these problems. Cyclic existence remains. Things in cyclic existence will never be perfect. So we have to, even though we're socially engaged, we have to remember that. In samsara, things are never going to be perfect. We're never going to succeed in having peace in the world and no health problems and everything. Why? Because the sentient beings in samsara, their minds are full of afflictions. And afflictions create karma, and karma leads to suffering. So as long as that's the situation, don't expect perfection. But making even a small contribution to one person or to 10 people to help them have peace of mind is worthwhile. We have done something. Giving up hope, withdrawing, and doing nothing is senseless. We are all tourists here on earth. We stay just a short time. So let's not be troublemakers while we are here. Every being wants to be happy and has the right to be. It is our responsibility to make a contribution towards their well-being, and we must do what we can. That is the purpose of our life. I want to teach this in Congress. Yeah. From a Buddhist viewpoint, cyclic existence has been faulty since beginningless time. Because all sentient beings are under the influence of afflictions and karma, trying to create a perfect world by rearranging external conditions is impossible. Because of this worldview, Tibetans do not expect so much from external situations. They accept difficulties more readily and are more easily satisfied. If we cultivate a view that does not expect fantastic happiness and magnificence in cyclic existence, we will be more content with what we have. Rather than leading to apathy or complacency, having modest expectations makes our minds more stable and prevents discouragement. Are we taught that? No, we're taught the opposite. We should have external bliss and happiness 24/7. We are entitled to it. It's unfair if we don't have it. Yeah, we should demand it. Yeah. And something's wrong with us if we don't have it. If I'm not so happy because I have so many friends on Facebook who put the thumbs up, and, you know, and if I'm not getting called on my phone every 5 minutes, even when I'm with my friends, so my friends know how popular I am, because other calls are coming in, even if they're fake calls and phony calls, it makes me look good, like I have a life. You know, if I don't have that, you know, my life is useless. You know, you read some of these things, the articles people write. Now, you know, when you read just the various articles, everybody is talking about their own individual suffering. Yeah. Everybody, you know, so many, you know, because so many things go wrong in samsara. So everybody tells the story of their own suffering. Yeah. And within each story, there's the feeling of it shouldn't be like this. Yeah. It shouldn't be like this. If society were better, if my family were kinder, if my friends cared more, if the government had better this or that or the other thing, or if the government would disappear so and stop interfering in my life, you know, always attributing the cause of the suffering outside, you know? And that in and of itself is so misery-making, isn't it? Yeah? Whenever you think, I'm miserable because of the world, instead of I'm miserable because of my own afflictions and karma, then, you know, that worldview just makes us more unhappy, doesn't it? Because we're powerless. We can't change anybody else. People ask me how I bear the suffering in Tibet. When I compare the suffering in Tibet with the suffering of cyclic existence, the latter is much worse. We can't close our eyes to suffering of any kind. Looking at our own suffering, we generate the determination to be free. This is compassion for ourselves. When seeing the suffering of others, we generate great compassion and bodhicitta and engage in practices that directly or indirectly contribute to their well-being. Sometimes we may want to help, but the situation may not allow it. You ever had that happen? You want to help, but you don't know what to do, or you're not there to help, or who knows what happens. I got a letter from one of the inmates I write to. He has a pen pal, and his pen pal, she's older, and she just had surgery. She was in the hospital for 3 months. She lost her apartment. She's living in a nursing home now. Her family doesn't offer to take care of her. And here's this guy in prison going, I wish I were free so I could help her. Yeah. So he's, you know, he's doing his best. He wants to help, but what can he do? People who do humanitarian work in war zones speak of the danger they face in places where human beings have many disturbing emotions and cannot think clearly. These aid workers have one foot there and one foot ready to run, because there is no value in their getting killed. I think of the people in Doctors Without Borders. I admire those people so much, you know, the situations where they operate their clinics and hospitals. Even if the Buddha were to go to some of these places, he could not do much to help. Under these circumstances, we may have to leave the situation physically, but can continue to send our compassion and pray for the well-being of those trapped there. We can actively work to educate people in danger of being drawn into the conflict. Although we may not be able to extinguish the fire, we can at least prevent it from spreading. Do not ignore the value of this. Well-meaning individuals ask me how to develop the courage to keep trying to make a difference in a world that seems so chaotic. No matter how numerous the difficulties, and no matter how large the obstacles, if our aim is reasonable and beneficial, we must keep our determination and maintain constant effort. If something is good for the larger community, it doesn't matter whether that goal materializes during our lifetime. We must keep working towards it. The next generation can build upon the good work we have done, and with time, things will change. And here I think of Elijah Cummings, the congressman who died last week, who was, you know, he's somebody I really admire, who really had a deep moral code, deep ethical code, and lived according it and spoke out against things and really supported the people in his district who were impoverished or facing an injustice. Yeah. So, quite amazing person. Wish we had more in Congress like him. Okay. So there's a few minutes for questions and comments.
To go back to the second paragraph about people's different temperaments and reflected in the two types of compassion, that reminded me of the hearer's path and then the bodhisattva's path. Mm-hmm. And saying that it comes down to people's temperaments kind of makes it seem like these things are innate or, you know, they're not so changeable. But I think, you know, maybe we could be working to expand the first kind of compassion into the second one.
Yeah. We have temperaments and dispositions, but they can change.
Yeah. Because I think I definitely have that first one. And I'm trying, you know, pretty hard to get the second one in.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like, oh, it's just go with the first one, you know.
Yeah.
That's good enough, but.
Yeah, but at a certain point, when you've heard certain teachings enough, if you think, oh, I'll just go with the first one, forget this one, you can't do it. Yeah. Yeah. You feel the Buddha tapping you on the shoulder.
As I was thinking about what you're saying about this clinging and craving mind that never has satisfaction, I was thinking more about those 6 years that the Buddha engaged in those ascetic practices. And actually, the little bit that I know about getting really hungry at a certain point and with not drinking, your mind gets on a high. And so I can imagine that at certain points, you know, you get sort of really attracted to these highs you get from, you know, keeping your body away from eating and drinking, and how that's just more ego building, and how it's just not a path to anywhere other than. Mm-hmm.
I think the Buddha drank.
Did he?
I think it was just food.
Just food
that he didn't take.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, we can get attached to anything.
It seems like that some people can take care of others very well, but not of themselves, right? Do you think it is the case?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
And why?
Why do you think?
Learning it maybe through the parents? Learning it through parents or community or I don't know really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do people think? Why do some people like to take care of other people, but they don't do very well taking care of themselves? Okay, wait, you got to use the mic and explain it a little
bit. I think it's a really wonderful distraction. I happen to be married to one of those people who likes to take care of other people. Uh-huh. And he's very beloved for it, but he does get the short end of the stick for himself.
Yeah.
And he knows it's a distraction.
Distraction from what?
His own... That's a really good question. Like the saying, the lazy man is the busy man. Not being with oneself, not being with.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Not being with oneself. Yeah. Keeps you busy taking care of others so you don't have to look at yourself. Yeah.
Maybe just because they want to be beloved by others and want to be liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be that.
I'm sure there's many reasons.
I love this last paragraph where His Holiness talks about how it's important for our aims to be reasonable and beneficial. And I think sometimes when you don't factor in that you are a limited being, right, as in you have limited capacity, that's it. If you're expecting to only care for others all the time, that's not a reasonable and beneficial aim. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what gets me in trouble, at least. I have way overinflated views of what I think I can do or what I can expect from a body like this. Yeah, or why I can't. I lived in a culture for a while where sleep was considered for weak people. You know, I've had to like undo those erroneous views. You know, you see people at college taking caffeine pills or whatever.
Yeah,
that's not reasonable nor beneficial.
Okay, so people having unreasonable expectations of what they should be able to do. So lots to think about here, huh? Yeah, and to look at where we're at, to assess, where we're at in relationship to all this, and to try and see a path forward in our own cultivation without underestimating our abilities and without overestimating them either.